Well, what is this feast all about? Let me ask it this way. What did it mean to the ancient Israelites? Anybody can tell me, I'm sure. Anybody want to volunteer it? What did it picture? What was the meaning of it for them? Well, I know you all know the answers. I won't call on anybody. I'll just go ahead and summarize what you already know. This feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, actually the Passover, beginning with the Passover, the whole season, Passover and Unleavened Bread, was a commemoration of the most important redemptive event in the history of the nation of Israel. And that was the Exodus from Egypt. Because God had promised Abraham that he would take his family, he would make of his family a great nation. He sent Abraham to a particular land and he said, "This is yours." You know, it's interesting that he tells Abraham, "This is your land, I have given it to you." And yet, at the end of Sarah's life, he had to purchase some place to bury her. He never owned the land. And we're told in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, that he dwelt in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob later, meaning tents, temporary dwellings, in the land of promise, not owning it, even though God said, "I've given this to you, it's yours." You know, he was speaking proleptically, obviously. The time will come when Abraham will receive that land. His children, his descendants, did receive it temporarily, but it's really a permanent possession. And so this Feast of Unleavened Bread reminded the Israelites annually that God had taken them out of Egyptian bondage and brought them through the wilderness and ultimately into the land of promise. Now, they had a lot of problems along the way. And once they got in the land, there were still a lot of problems. It wasn't a problem with God. He was faithful to his promises. The problem was with the people, as we saw last time we were here. We looked at some of that. I'd like to go back and just briefly summarize those events that led directly to the Exodus from Egypt. In chapter 7 of the book of Exodus, let's go back there. Let's begin in chapter 6, the last few verses there. Verse 28, "On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, 'I am the Lord,'" or "I am Yahweh. 'Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you.' But Moses said to the Lord, 'Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me?'" Now, it's not really certain exactly what this refers to here. Some said, well, he was a stutterer, had some kind of speech impediment. I don't really think that's the case. I think, in all probability, you have to keep in mind that Moses had been away from Egypt for a very long time. And now he'd picked up a different dialect, perhaps a different language. And he was dwelling with a different people and had been for many, many years. And now he's going back to Egypt and he doesn't speak the language so well. But here's what God says. He says, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh.'" In the Hebrew, literally, it says, "I have made you God to Pharaoh." In other words, you are my agent. You are going to be my representative. Pharaoh looks at you, he's looking at my agent, therefore he's hearing from me. But since you have this problem of communication, he goes on to say, "and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet." So Moses was God by means of agency, and his brother Aaron was his prophet, so Aaron would do the talking for him. So evidently Moses was able to communicate quite well with Aaron. He spoke the language, apparently, and then Aaron could communicate the message to Pharaoh. And then we read about what happened when they went before. Well, let's go ahead and read here what God says he's going to do. "You shall speak all that I command you," verse 2, "and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you." Now, what does this mean when he says, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart"? You know, a lot of people think that God reached down into his mind and, you know, punched the right buttons and pulled the right levers and changed Pharaoh's heart. In other words, Pharaoh might have let them go, but since God directly acted on Pharaoh's mind and caused him to harden himself, he didn't. Is that what it means? No, no. We're going to see exactly how God did harden Pharaoh's heart. It's not that he needed to reach down and do something to Pharaoh to cause him to harden his heart, because Pharaoh was a man who did not fear God. Pharaoh was, after all, the king of Egypt. He was an arrogant man. He was a man who had hardened himself. In fact, we're going to see some examples here that show us that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And then we'll see why and how it was that it could be said that God hardened his heart. Well, I'll tell you beforehand. If someone came to you and just out of the blue slapped you, would that make you, how would you feel? I think you would be angry, at least momentarily, wouldn't you? You know, when I was a kid, I had that happen. Some guy, a real friend, right? That wasn't a slap, it was a fist. I don't know, out of the blue, he just decided to hit me. And, I could say, he made me mad. Now, the anger arose within me. That was my anger. It came up from inside, but I could say, he brought out that anger. So God hardens Pharaoh's heart by acting in Egypt, by doing things, by bringing on plagues, by lifting plagues, by giving him commands through Moses that causes Pharaoh to react in hardening his heart. He hardened his own heart. So it could be said, yes, God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and it could be said Pharaoh hardened his own heart, because he was, after all, a hard-hearted man, a man who did not fear God. So he says that he's going to do this, and Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. Now, you know, God could have raptured them all out. He could have just swept them up and taken them to the land. He could have caused the other people, he could have just driven them right out of there. But he used all of these different things, these different plagues that befell Egypt. And he let Pharaoh resist. And he kept coming back. What was the purpose of all of that? It's right here. He wanted to show them who God was. You know, if the Israelites had just disappeared, they said, where'd they go? What happened? But God wanted to show them, and he wanted to show not only the Egyptians, but he knew that the Egyptians would tell others. He knew that many people from other nations came into Egypt. Some of them fled there from famines. Remember when Israel went out of Egypt, a mixed multitude went with them. But he wanted the nations to know that he was God. So you can imagine what kind of story went around. You can imagine how the news must have spread when the God of Hebrew slaves defeated the mighty Pharaoh. That must have been some kind of hair-raising, jaw-dropping type of story, a news story to go around. So we're told here that right away, when he goes before Pharaoh, he says, "Okay, show me some miracles to show me that God has really sent you." So Aaron casts down the rod. You know the story. It becomes a snake, and then here comes Pharaoh's magicians. They do the same thing, using their secret arts, whatever that was. Probably some of it was trickery, but in some of the things they did may have involved demonic activity. I don't know to what extent. Some of it was probably just magician's tricks, and some of it was probably demonic activity. But in any case, here they come and they repeat it. And what happens? Does Pharaoh say, even after Moses' rod, his snake, ate up the others? So what does he do? You think, say, well, that's interesting. Your serpent ate mine, ours. But no, it says in verse 13, still Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. And then comes the first plague. The first plague was when the water was turned into blood. Aaron stretched out his hand, stretched out his staff, and the water all over the place started turning into blood. Well, guess what? Guess who else was able to do that? Pharaoh's magicians. So it wasn't very impressive. not to Pharaoh. It wasn't very impressive. So we read in verse 22, but the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. And then comes the next plague. The second plague is the plague of frogs. This time frogs came out of the Nile. They came up everywhere. They were just all over the place. And actually, that's not something anybody would want. When you got them in your home, you got them, you can't move without frogs everywhere. You know, everywhere are frogs. And so Moses, using his prophet Aaron, acted and through God's power caused the frogs to come forth. Guess who else did? It says in verse 7, but the magicians did the same by their secret arts and made frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So I guess they helped bring the plague on themselves. But the point here is that, you know, this might have gotten Pharaoh's attention because this was a very annoying thing. But then the magicians did it, and what happens? But when Pharaoh saw, this is in verse 15, when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, that is with the plague of frogs, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So here, again and again, you see that he keeps hardening his heart. He's not going to let these people go. His mind is made up at this point. He's not going to do it. And then comes the third plague. It's a plague of gnats. Verse 19, then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And it says before that that the magicians tried to, by their secret arts, to produce gnats, but they could not. Here's something they couldn't do. Finally, something they couldn't do. They could bring out frogs. They could turn water into blood, but they couldn't bring forth the gnats. Well, I'll tell you what, just leave out some cantaloupe or something like that for a little while and you can bring forth the gnats. But they couldn't do this one, and so therefore they said, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. So again, you have Pharaoh's hard heart. His unwillingness to listen, certainly at this point he is not about to let the Hebrews leave the land. And then comes the fourth plague, is the plague of flies. Plague of flies. And the land was ruined, we're told, by this swarm of flies. Can you imagine that? Flies everywhere. I don't even like a very minor plague of flies. I don't like it just, you know, when a few of them in the room, two or three of them, they just annoy me to death. Can you imagine flies everywhere? I'm not sure exactly what kind of flies they had. They had big old Egyptian flies or something, but in any case, whatever they were. It says that they ruined. They were ruining the land. It was a very ruinous thing going on. And then it just drop on down to verse 28. So Pharaoh said, "I will let you go to sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only you must not go very far away. Plead for me." Then Moses said, "Behold, I am going out from you, and I will plead with the Lord that the swarms of flies may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people tomorrow. Only let not Pharaoh cheat again by not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." So Moses went out from Pharaoh and prayed to the Lord, and the Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from the people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh, what did he do? He said, "Well, I got to keep my word." No. Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also and did not let the people go. So, you know, when the plagues were on, there were times when Pharaoh said, okay, you win. And he tried to reason with, tried to deal with Moses or tried to bargain with him. You want to let everybody know? No, just the men. Or certain men. No, we want old and young alike. Okay, and then another point, you know, he says, okay, but not your flocks and herds. Not any of your livestock. He said, no, everything. And so he was this bargaining back and forth, and of course Pharaoh kept hardening his heart. There was the fifth plague. This is when the Egyptians' livestock were struck. They died. But it says that none of the livestock of the Israelites died. They were not in this plague. They were not destroyed in the plague. And then we're told in verse 7, and Pharaoh sent, and behold, not one of the livestock of Israel was dead, but the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. You know, at times he was probably hardened because of his anger of what was going on. Other times he seemed to be giving in, but Moses always knew that he was a man who did not fear God. And he kind of had an idea that as soon as a plague was lifted, he would harden his heart again. And that's what you see going on here. Then the sixth plague was a plague of boils. And dropping on down to verse 12, but the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. Here it says the Lord hardened his heart, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Well, let's read before then in verse 10. Says, so they took soot from the kiln and stood before Pharaoh. This is Moses and Aaron. And Moses threw it in the air, and it became boils breaking out in sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils came upon the magicians and upon the Egyptians. But, you know, Pharaoh hardened his heart anyway and did not listen to them as the Lord had spoken to Moses. So sometimes he would react in apparent anger. He'd see these things going on. And rather than give in, you know, he was obviously a very prideful man, as I think you would find most ancient kings of at that time, maybe kings all throughout history actually, did tend to be prideful people. And then came the plague of hail. It was a very destructive hail. Let's read the first few verses there. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and your people so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. Now this was his object. This was one of the things he intended to do anyway. This is what God wanted to do. I want you to see it. I want your people to see it. That, you know, you worship all of these gods through these idols you have. You worship gods that have the images of beasts and men, and sometimes those merge together. And I want you to know that there is none like me. I want you to know that I am God, and these idols are not. For by now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. He could have destroyed them all by now. He hasn't done so. He sent these plagues because he has a purpose for doing so. He wants them to see. He wants them to know he is God. And he wants them to tell others that he is God. The gods of the nations are not true gods. He and he alone is God. But for this purpose, very important verse here, for this purpose I have raised you up to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. So that's the purpose. That's why he let Pharaoh sit on the throne. He could have destroyed him long ago. He could have prevented him from ever taking the throne. He could have killed his mother, you know, before he was born. There wouldn't have been a Pharaoh if he so desired it. He says, but for this purpose I have raised you up to show you my power and thereby show the rest of the people, the other nations, his power and show that he was God. To show that the God of these Hebrew slaves was the true God. That's what he intended to do. So this plague of hail did come and it was tremendously destructive. More destructive than anything before. Taking up the account, continuing the account, verse 28, only in the land of Goshen, where the people of Israel were, was there no hail. So that ought to get your attention. Everything else is being destroyed by hail. The barley and the flax were destroyed. Even trees were destroyed. It's a hailstorm like none had ever seen. And yet there was Goshen untouched. I think if I were Pharaoh at this point, I'd be about ready to go ahead and say, well, there is somebody greater than me, you know, and let the people go. So this is what happened, though. Verse 27, then Pharaoh sent and called Moses and Aaron and said to them, This time I have sinned and the Lord is in the right and I and my people are in the wrong. I guess the other times they weren't in the wrong. But this time, yes, I've sinned. I'm in the wrong this time. God was wrong the other times, I guess. Plead with the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. Moses said to him, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will stretch out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease, and there will be no more hail, so that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, now get this, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord God. So Moses himself knew it. Perhaps God revealed that to him. Or maybe Moses could simply see it at this point for having dealt with Pharaoh. So he says, I know that you do not yet fear God. And then drop on down to verse 34. When Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet again and hardened his heart, he and his servants. So the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people of Israel go, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. I guess it's kind of like that prayer you remember praying in a thunderstorm when you were a kid. Get me through this one, Lord. Get me through this one, and I won't do some of those things that, you know, Mama told me not to be doing some of those things anymore. I will walk the straight and narrow. Just get me through this terrible night of thunder and lightning. And then it's beautiful the next day, and you kind of forget about those promises, don't you? Pharaoh not only forgot, he hardened himself. He was a man that didn't fear God, as Moses said. He knew it. And so as soon as the hail stopped and the thundering stopped and all the things that caused fear were taken away, well, it's back to the same old game again. Then came the eighth plague, the plague of locusts. Then the Lord said to Moses, go in to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among them, and that they may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. See, this is an important part of this. He wants these things to be remembered. And he wants Moses to tell his son, his grandson, and this information to be passed on from generation to generation so they would forever keep in mind who God is. Because these people are going to be in the presence of all kinds of false religions, all kinds of false gods. When they go out to the nations, when they go into the land of Canaan, they're going to be confronted with all kinds of idolatry and everything under the sun that you can imagine. And God wants them to remember that He is God and that none of these other gods, so-called, are. He alone is God. So tell it to your son. Tell it to your grandchildren. So he has the future in mind as these things are happening. He deliberately sets out to do these things so that they will be remembered, so that the report will be spread to other peoples, so that his name will be glorified among the nations, so that people will know that he, and he alone, is God. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said to him, thus says the Lord God, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me. For you, if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your country, and they shall cover the face of the land, and that no one can see the land. And they shall eat what is left to you after the hail. And they shall eat every tree of yours that grow in the field, and they will fill their houses and the houses of all your servants and all of the Egyptians. And then he turned and went out from Pharaoh. And then Pharaoh's servants said to him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go. Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do not yet understand that Egypt is ruined? This is Pharaoh's advisors. So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, go serve the Lord your God. But which ones are to go? So he tries to do a little bargaining with him here. Certain ones can go, but not... And Moses says, no. Our old and our young, our livestock, everything. We all go. We're not going to go someplace in the land. We're leaving the land. So we're told that... Once again, the eighth plague, the plague of locusts, it ended with this. Let's drop on over to verse 16. Then Pharaoh hastily called Moses and Aaron and said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Once again, same thing. Now therefore forgive my sin, please, only this once, and plead with the Lord your God only to remove the death from me. So he went out from Pharaoh and pleaded with the Lord, and the Lord turned the wind into a very strong west wind, which lifted the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not a single locust was left in all the country of Egypt. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people go. What's it going to take? Well, there comes the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. Once again, Pharaoh hardens his heart. Then comes the threat of the final plague, and then we have the final plague described for us. It's the death of the firstborn. He said at this particular time, and he tells the people what to do. They were to kill the lamb, put the blood on their homes, and he says, in this night, the lamb was killed on the 14th day, Ben Harbim, which means between the evenings. We believe that to be a reference to the whole afternoon period, for the sacrifice of the lambs. They placed the blood on the doorposts and lintels, and then that night, the beginning of the 15th, that's when the death passed over. It passed through the land of Egypt. It killed all the firstborn, from Pharaoh right on down to all of them, except for the people who were in those homes, the firstborn who were in those homes marked by the blood of the Lamb. Now, obviously, we're seeing some symbolism here, aren't we? They were saved by the blood of the lambs. Ring a bell? Well, of course it does. Yeah, a lot of types and anti-types. We see these beginning to emerge. And I want to call your attention to something that we're going to get to a little bit later. Moses is here as God's agent, is dealing with principalities and powers. Pharaoh, arguably the greatest power on earth at that time, at least in relation to the people of Israel. He was dealing with these principalities, with rulers, powerful rulers who had control over their lives. Keep that in mind, because we're going to come to some anti-types when we get to the New Testament. And so the Passover takes place. The death angel, as we say, passed through the land. God passed over the homes marked by blood, and he struck dead the firstborn. And of course, you know what happened. Pharaoh finally says, take your people, take your flocks, take your herds, and get out. And the people were urgent on them. And of course, that's the meaning of unleavened bread. The reason they had were told to eat unleavened bread during this memorial festival was because in Egypt they had to hastily get out. They didn't have time. They didn't run down to the store and buy yeast, I don't think. But they usually kneaded their bread and they placed it out so that it would pick up the yeast spores naturally. And then they would put it in the oven, bake it, and they would have leavened bread. But they didn't have time for all that. They just took their dough and ran. Just bundled it up and took off with whatever belongings they had themselves, and they took the flocks and the herds, and a mixed multitude went out with them. We read in verse 17, chapter 12, and you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a statute forever. That tells you why, doesn't it? This feast was for them a commemoration of, a memorial of, the great redemptive act of God that brought them together, brought them out of Egypt as a nation, and ultimately brought them to the promised land. That great act, a redemptive act, which we call the Exodus. So this was the 10th plague, was the death of the firstborn, and that was what finally did it. And then you have the institution of the Passover, and of course the unleavened bread is mentioned here. And then we want to come on over to move on over to chapter 14. Chapter 14, we see how Israel encamped from place to place. We're not going to read through all of that, but they finally they came up to the what's called the Red Sea here. So there are different opinions on what that really is, Sea of Reeds or whatever it was. Anyway, we'll call it the Red Sea. They came up to the Red Sea, and what happens? What happens? Old repentant Pharaoh, who finally did let the people go, decides what? He's going to go after them. So he was hardened once again. And this time God intervenes. And you know what happens. Let's just go right to the end of the story in chapter 14 and verse 30. Thus the Lord, get these words here, saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. He parted the waters of the Red Sea. They passed through. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in His servant Moses. That's interesting. They believed in the Lord and in His servant, that's His agent that He used, Moses. So you see, it's important to keep these things in mind, because you begin, as you look at the details, you see all kinds of types here. Types of things that will happen to bring about an even greater salvation. He says the Lord saved Israel. How so? Through use of His agent, Moses. And it was through His agent, Moses, that He brought about these plagues, that He lifted the plagues. And you get the impression that from time to time when Moses spoke to God, God responded to him. Moses evidently had the power to keep those plagues on a little longer had he sought to do so. But when he would inquire, when he would beseech God, lift the plague, God would respond. You see this happening. But Moses was God's agent. And he appeared before Pharaoh as God's representative. All this is very important, because you see that Moses was, in fact, a type of Christ. Typologically, he tells us something about Jesus Christ. So now then, I want us to go with all of that in mind, that backdrop and what this meant to the ancient Israelites. And many of the Jews today recall the story come Passover time. But I want us to go to Colossians, the first chapter. But on your way over there, make a brief stop at 1 Corinthians 10, which we looked at the last time I was here. And we're just going to read one verse here to remind us of something. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1, Paul says, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that our fathers were all under the cloud. Now he's talking about the cloud, the cloud by day, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night that led the Israelites out of Egypt. He said, I want you all to know, my brothers and sisters, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They were saved, in other words, as we just read, by virtue of their identification with Moses. As I said, I mentioned it last time, if some Israelites decided, say, well, we're going to go that way, I don't think that would work very well. No, Israel was saved by virtue of their identification and association with God's agent, Moses. And they were, in that sense, baptized into Moses. So do you see some types here, typology? We're baptized into Christ, who is that ultimate prophet like Moses. He's the new Moses, just as he's the new David and the new Adam. So we're baptized into Christ as they were baptized into Moses. And our baptism then, well, that's what it represents. And it is unto a greater salvation than the salvation they experienced. So with all of that in mind, now let's go to Colossians chapter 1. I want to give you a little background here of the book of Colossians and what the problems were. It does tell us something about principalities and powers. That's why I wanted to focus, I wanted to emphasize that Moses was up against a ruler, the ruler of Egypt. And apparently also some of the principalities and powers in the spiritual dimension working behind the scenes through the magicians and the sorcerers in Pharaoh's realm. But here we're told that Christ has prevailed over the principalities and the powers. We're going to see Christ as the ultimate antitype, as the ultimate one who would fulfill what Moses typified. In the backdrop of the book of Colossians, you see some words that are used. Words such as the fullness, you see it repeated. Mystery, he repeatedly talks about mystery, fullness, fullness of God, and also about the elemental spirits, or as some translations say, elements of the world. Now, these were particular terms that pertain to the problem that was taking place in Colossae. Certain false teachers had come along, and they were urging the people there in the Colossian church to turn to the elemental spirits and to practice asceticism. Now, what for? Well, the Greek word translated elemental spirits in this translation, I'm using the English Standard Version today, and it's elements of the world or simply elements in some other translation. But the Greek word translated elemental spirits, and we'll see it in the text itself in just a little while, it was used in this particular time period to refer to gods and stars and planets. In other words, astrological, astral powers. There were people who believed in astral and cosmic powers, and that these things controlled the destiny of humans. Now, you've heard of that before, haven't you? You ever read your horoscope? They believed that the planets and the stars were associated with gods or heavenly beings, and these controlled our fate. Now, how is it that you drive out fear of these controlling entities, these elemental spirits? What do you do? Well, the philosophers of that time said that what you do, you practice asceticism. You practice asceticism. And in this case, in the Colossian church, at least the false teachers that came among them, it was as a means of overcoming the fear of these astral and cosmic powers, and perhaps also getting on their good side, I guess you could say. In other words, controlling your fate to some extent, that they were actually in charge of your fate. But in any case, what the philosophers claim that you need to be doing is using asceticism. And they also encouraged worship of angels. They were having ecstatic experiences, claiming to receive revelations, apparently from angels, but receive revelations, and were teaching the people that to drive out fear of the astral and cosmic forces that controlled them, and perhaps take some of the control for themselves, that the way to do that was through the worship of angels and through asceticism. Do you know what asceticism is? It's a bunch. It's a whole bunch of rules. Do this and don't do that. Not talking about moral law. We're talking about things like do not touch, do not taste, do not handle. You go without food on this day. You don't eat meat on that day. Practice of asceticism, a very rigorous system whereby you supposedly purge yourself of your carnal appetites and so on. It involved fasting, among other things, and all kinds of things. So I suppose that some of these philosophers, so-called, were sitting out in caves and maybe even using some other substances while they were there, while they were fasting, and they were getting into a state of ecstasy, and they were having visions. And revelations were coming to them. Reminds you of Muhammad, doesn't it? There have been lots of so-called prophets across the centuries who have done this, who've used this kind of practice. And this is what was going on. Certain people who were influencing the church at Colossae, they were practicing these things. Now, you think, well, that's all pagan. Well, yes, it was. Yes, it was. But it actually had affected certain Jewish groups, Jewish mystics, had merged these practices with their belief in the angels. So rather than gods controlling the planets and the stars and so on and affecting the fate of men, they thought in terms of angels. And indeed, Paul acknowledges that there is an angelic hierarchy, but as we read in the book of Hebrews, the angels are ministering spirits sent forth to minister to the heirs of salvation. They are not controllers of the fate of human beings in the astrological sense. So let's say, with that in the backdrop, let's read a few verses in chapter 1. It's talking about Christ, and in verse 15 it says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation." Now, that needs some explanation there, because people seize that, they look at that and say, ah, he was a created being, he was created before anything else. That's not what this verse is telling us. This has nothing to do with his being a created being. It's not what it's telling us. The word firstborn, the term firstborn, it was used in ancient times. It was, the firstborn son would, of course, be the principal heir of an estate. He was the primary heir of an estate. So what is this saying when Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, speaking of God the Father, and the firstborn, that means he's the heir of all creation. That's what it means. He has speaking of his preeminence. It's not talking about his being created before the world was. Not at all. So he has preeminence over all creation, and he's the heir of all things, because God is the Father and creator of all things. For by him, or in him, it could be translated either way, all things were created in heaven and on earth. Now get this, visible and invisible. Now what kinds of things does he have in mind? Things in heaven and things on earth. Here he is not speaking of galaxies and quasars and things of that nature. I mean, it would include that, but that's not what he has in view. He tells us what he has in view. He says, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. Heaven and earth. The angelic hierarchy, as well as any powers and authorities and dominions and rulers on earth, that would include all the pharaohs. It would include every ruler, every king. He has power. All these things were created for him. Now, does this mean that God necessarily instituted every government on earth? No. No, it doesn't. But what it does mean, I believe what it does suggest here, is that God gave Adam dominion, not only over the animals, but over the whole earth. I don't believe that just means that he would be a lot smarter than the animals. No, I believe what is the point there, God gave his own dominion to Adam so that Adam then would create an orderly society. He and his descendants would create an orderly society. Of course, things kind of went wrong, didn't they? But nevertheless, this was the point. And so therefore, all legitimate authority, governmental authority, flows in that sense from God. I think you can see what he's talking about here. So what he's saying here is that these things were created, or part of God's original intent, these rulers and thrones and dominions, all legitimate forms of authority, but it had a particular goal in mind. And what this is telling us, that Christ is not only is he the agent of creation, he's the goal of creation. And all of this points to what? The new creation, a renewal of creation itself. And through whom will the creation be renewed? God's agent, in this case, not Moses, but Christ. And here he speaks of principalities and powers, or thrones and dominions and rulers and authorities. He goes on to say, verse 17, "And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church." He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Now, this is not talking about pre-existence. It's talking about his exaltation after having been resurrected from the dead. The firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent, That's what it means to be the firstborn, to be preeminent. That speaks of his preeminence. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Now, why would Paul be making these statements? Remember, he just doesn't make up things that sound nice. So, oh, that sounds kind of poetic. I think I'll use that. No. There's obviously a backdrop story to this. Apparently, the philosophers that were coming to Colossae and deceiving the people taught or teaching them that through the practice of asceticism, they could experience the fullness of God. And there are people that teach that sort of thing today. You find it in the New Age movement and so on. You want to experience the fullness of God in your life, you know, then you practice the practice of asceticism or whatever it is, meditation, different things that you supposedly can do. But Paul is saying that in him, he is the preeminent one. Christ is the preeminent one. And in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. So if you want to experience the fullness of God, where do you go to experience it? It's not from the practice of asceticism. It's not through emphasis on a hierarchy of angels and worship of angels. It's on going directly to God through Jesus Christ, God's agent, who has preeminence over all the principalities and powers, over every ruler and every authority and every throne. And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, once you were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. And it's interesting that here he refers to the church as the body back in verse 18 it is. And here, though, he speaks of the body of his flesh, talking about his actual body. You see the connection here. At times he talks about the body of Christ being Christ's body that hang on the stake, the body that was given and that died. As a sacrificial death. And at other times he speaks of the church as the body. You see what he's saying, don't you? It is by his body that he reconciled us to God. And now, therefore, he's still the head of the body, but now the spiritual body is the church. In other words, he still dwells in the church. He still has that connection, just as the head was connected with the physical body. Now he, as the head, is connected with the spiritual body, which is the church. In order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. If indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, this tells you right here, there's an if, the two-letter I word, if you continue in the faith, if you continue steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. He points this out to them because now they are hearing a different gospel, and some of them are responding to it, and they think that they can experience the fullness of God by the worship of angels and the practice of asceticism. Now, whether this worship of angels means actual worship of angels, or whether it's referring to emphasis on angels in their worship, it's not really clear. But the point is that we're wrongly emphasizing the role of angels in their worshipful practice. And then let's read just a few more verses here. It says, now I rejoice, in verse 24, now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I am filled up with what is lacking in Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, that is, the church. So here again, now the church is the body, figuratively speaking and spiritually speaking, of which I became a minister according to the stewardship of God that was given to me for you to make the word of God fully known. The mystery hidden for ages and generations, but now revealed in his saints. He's using the false teacher's own words. You know, the mysteries, elemental spirits and so forth. Then in chapter 2, let's skip on over to verse 6. Therefore, as you received Christ Jesus the Lord to walk in Him, rooted and built up in Him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving, see to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit. Now here he's talking specifically about the false teaching. He's going to mention asceticism shortly, and he's going to mention the elemental spirits that we referred to. According to to human tradition, according to elemental spirits, there it is. Elemental spirits. In the pagan world, as I said, it was believed to be the astral powers and the cosmic powers that control men's fates and were connected with the stars and the planets. And as I said, had actually spilled over into and was adopted by Jewish mystic sects. And apparently these are the people who were advocating it in the churches in Colossae, because we read something else here that leads us to that conclusion. According to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. For in Him the whole fullness of deity, there's that again, the fullness of God, the fullness of deity dwells bodily. There's the body again, reference to the body. In this case, it's His actual body. And you have been filled in Him who is the head of all rule and authority. In Him also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. This is talking about not what happened on the eighth day of His life, but what happened on the last day of His mortal existence. The cutting of His flesh, resulting in His death. Having been buried with Him in baptism, in which you were also raised with Him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised Him from the dead. And you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with Him, having forgiven us all our trespasses. And this is all in contrast to the philosophy that was being advocated regarding the worship of angels and the use of asceticism. By canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. That may read differently in your King James Version. It may seem to suggest that he's talking about the law here. Not at all. It's talking about the record of debt that was accrued due to our transgressing the law. That's what he's canceled. That's what's been nailed to the stake. That's what's been taken out of the way, so that there any accuser who would bring that up has no grounds for accusation. And this is what he's going to talk about here. By canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands, this he set aside, nailing it to the cross. Now this was the result as well of his sacrificial work. He disarmed the rulers and authorities. Reminds you of someone else, another agent that God used in ancient Egypt, Moses. Here you see Christ disarming rulers and authorities in an even greater way. And put them to an open shame by triumphing over them in Him. Now, who are these rulers and authorities? He's talking about the spiritual principalities and powers. That's very important because the Colossians were emphasizing the hierarchy of angels. And here he is saying Christ is vastly superior to the angelic realm. He has conquered the evil principalities and authorities, those who would be the accusers of the brethren. You know, when he's taken out the record of sin, when he's removed that, when he's nailed that to the cross, then what does the devil have? The devil is called the accuser of the brethren. What does he have to accuse us with? He doesn't have anything. So that's one of the ways in which he disarms the principalities and the powers. But you know, the language that's used here, it's commonly understood by commentaries that when he says, for example, putting them to open shame, the image here, it may not be familiar to us, but it would have been familiar to the Colossians, is that of a Roman general with his white horse riding victoriously after a battle and leading the captives behind him. That's what they used to do in those days. When they would defeat a people in war, then the general, and sometimes maybe the emperor himself, would ride victoriously into Rome with the cheering crowds, and you'd have all these captives bound behind him, and he would be leading them in procession to display them. This is open shame. They're defeated, and he is the victor. Rome is the victor. And so here this is applied to Christ. He is presented as the one who has defeated the hostile principalities and powers, and now he leads them in this procession, figuratively speaking, in an open shame. In other words, the devil has had it. Doesn't mean he's not active. Doesn't mean he's not still active. But his days are numbered. It does mean that he was defeated at the cross, at the death of Christ. Defeated. And then he says, therefore, because of this, because the principalities and powers have been defeated, because the record of debt and its legal demands have been nailed to the cross, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink. Now, this is a controversial passage here, and the one that I think is often misunderstood. Or with regard to a festival, like the one we're observing here today, or a new moon, or a Sabbath. You know, people read that and say, well, there it is. How much clearer could it get? You shouldn't be doing these things. Those heretics must have been teaching those are things you need to be doing. And here Paul is saying, no, you don't need to do those things. Is that what he's saying, really? But notice he says, questions of food and drink. Were these people not eating and drinking? Of course they were. So what would this particular set of false teachings, what does this have to do with food and drink? Well, think about it. They were practicing asceticism. They would tell you, no wine, no meat, none of this, none of that. You're having too much fun. Can't do that. Nope. Too much festivities. So they were judging them in food and drink. Has nothing to do with clean and unclean laws. And it's not what he has in mind, because he says food and drink. Or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. Now, what would the asceticists be doing in regards to festivals and Sabbath and the Sabbath day? They would be observing them in a very, very strict and perhaps, well, not so pleasant, a way that would be overly strict, because they would have their rules of asceticism attached to the festivals and the Sabbath. Can't do this, can't do that. Do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, as Paul will use this, will mention this a little bit later. So here they were obviously, the Colossians were being judged because they were obviously enjoying and celebrating and rejoicing in festivals and Sabbaths and in eating and drinking every time they got together. I get the impression, reading through the book of Acts and reading various passages, that every time they got together, they're kind of like us. They like to eat. Everybody likes that, don't they? And so, but you had the asceticists who were coming along and imposing regulations on all of those things. So you can't use this passage here to say that, that shows you right there, the festivals and Sabbaths and so on were not for Christians. It doesn't show you any such thing. It's interesting, you find scholars today who acknowledge that. I'm talking about Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians and whatnot. They acknowledge the Colossians were, as they would put it, most likely enjoying festivals and Sabbaths and potlucks and all of that sort of thing. And the asceticists were saying, too much fun. And then he goes on to say, these are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. There's that word again. The same word translated body elsewhere. The body belongs to Christ. So what is he saying here? These are a shadow of things to come. Sabbaths, festivals, and so on. These are a shadow, but the body belongs to Christ. What does he mean? Well, you have the reality of the shadow. You have the reality. It's Christ. It is his body that casts the shadow. So when you celebrate by use of the shadows, when we come together to rejoice and celebrate and remember the things of God and study the things of God, what are we doing? I mean, what are we really doing? We're honoring the one who casts the shadow, Jesus Christ. And he's reminding them of this because they're now focused on something else. A hierarchy of angels and the practice of asceticism. They say, no. It's all about Christ. His is the body that casts these shadows. And they had the wrong view of all of this because of the false teachers. Let no one disqualify you insisting on asceticism and worship of angels. There it is. Going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind. That's what Paul thought about it. The people were having these ecstatic experiences and then coming and telling what all revelations they had received while they were in this, fasting in the cave for days on end or whatever it was they were doing. And not holding fast to the head from which the whole body, there's that word again, and this time it refers to the church, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that is from God. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, if you put away those things you once practiced, the worship of angels or the emphasis on astral and cosmic things, belief in astrology, that the stars and planets or the gods that controlled them somehow controlled your destiny. If you have died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Now he's talking about asceticism. Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Referring to things that all perish as they are used, according to human precepts and teachings. Notice, human precepts and teachings. This was the philosophy of men. He's not talking of, some people actually read this and they think, oh, he's talking about the old Mosaic laws. Do not handle, do not touch, clean and unclean things and all that. No, that's not what he has in mind at all. He's talking about the practice of asceticism according to human precepts and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body. You know, some of the practitioners may think they look real spiritual. You know what he's saying here? That's not the key to spirituality. The key to true spirituality is you need to be joined with God's agent, the one who has overcome the principalities and powers, the one who is preeminent over all authorities and powers. And by being connected with him, then that's the source of real spirituality and a right relationship with God. It is not through worship of angels and the practice of asceticism. But they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. Isn't that interesting? People who emphasize asceticism, people who are practicing all kinds of do not touch, do not taste, do not handle rules. And yet, Paul says that these do little in stopping the indulgences of the flesh. Why is that? Well, I think probably because when these people stop doing those things, here they're living with very little, they probably have something like a vow of poverty, and yet they were also puffed up in their own imaginations in their claim to having received revelations in their ecstatic experiences. So Paul says, it does little for in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. And he goes on to tell them that they are to put on the new self. And of course, the new self is through identification with Christ. So here we have God's agent, who is Jesus Christ. And he is preeminent over, and he has conquered the principalities and powers, and has preeminence as firstborn, that's the heir of all things. And just as the people of Israel were saved from Egyptian oppression, just as they were saved from the hands of Pharaoh by their identification with and connection with Moses, So we, through our identification with and connection with Jesus Christ, the one who bears the image of God, the one who in Him the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, by our connection with Him, the one who is truly King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the one who is over all dominions and powers and authorities, we have an even greater salvation. So let's use the Feast of Unleavened Bread to rejoice and to celebrate that great salvation we have in God's agent. God's agent being Jesus Christ, who is far greater than Moses, far greater than any of the prophets, greater than David, greater than Adam, for in Him the fullness of God was pleased to dwell.